Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this joint project tonight, sponsored by the Cold War Studies Centre here at the London School of Economics, but in fact organised in more ways than one by our good friends at the Institute for the Study of the Americas at the University of London. And we're delighted as a centre and as an institution to host this 2006 James Bryce Lecture on the American Commonwealth. I was trying to think of things to say this evening, but let me just say three things, and you always say things in threes. Firstly, I think it's entirely appropriate that the LSE is hosting this evening, because we're such a nice institution, as you well know, and like to reach out hands at a time when the University of London tragically is being broken up. I think this is a marvellous statement about why the University of London should remain in being, and I hope somebody quotes that. Secondly, of course, coincidentally, although I like to say that all things are well planned by the Cold War Studies Centre, it fits very brilliantly and wonderfully and neatly into a series of lectures we have been organising and participating in for the whole year, which is actually called America as Another Country. And, of course, the theme of this lecture this evening deals very directly with the United States and the historical experience of the United States. And thirdly, by a complete coincidence again, but of course I will say it's wonderfully well planned by us, the speaker this evening, Professor Orlando Patterson, of course, got his PhD in sociology from the London School of Economics in 1965. I will forgive him the sociology, but I won't forgive him the fact that he got his PhD from the London School of Economics in 1965. Welcome back, Professor Patterson. It's wonderful to have you here, and I'll now hand you over to Ewan Morgan, who will actually be the host for this evening. But anyway, once again, welcome to the Institute, and welcome to Professor Patterson. Ewan, over to you.
Well, thanks very much, Mick. Well, welcome everybody to the 2006 James Bryce Lecture on the American Commonwealth. For those of you who don't know James Bryce was one of the towering figures of late Victorian and Edwardian Britain. His career took many turns, and he was successful in all of them, first of all as an Oxford Don specialising in jurisprudence, a liberal statesman who served in several cabinet positions, a diplomat who was British ambassador in Washington, and even as an explorer, Mount Bryce in the Rockies is actually named after him. The Institute for the Study of the Americas was formed 2 years ago out of the merger of the Institute of United States Studies and the Institute for Latin American Studies. And the Bryce Lecture was a tradition established by the Institute of United States Studies, and we now in our guides at ISA are delighted to carry it on. And as Americanists, we have two particular reasons to celebrate James Bryce. Firstly, it was Bryce who in 1921 gave the inaugural lecture for the George Watson Chair of American History, Literature and Institutions at the University of London. And that is significant as the first acknowledgement by an English university, or indeed a British university, that the United States was a legitimate field of study. This was, in effect, the first ever chair in an American-related subject anywhere in the UK. And Bryce was chosen for that particular distinction because of his earlier pioneering work in informing British audiences about the United States when that nation was on the cusp of its rise to world power. Bryce's seminal study, The American Commonwealth, published in 1888, stands comparison with Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America as one of the two great commentaries on 19th century American politics and society. Bryce saw in America more than just America. He once wrote, "The interests of the United States are something more than an experiment, for they are believed to disclose and display the type of institutions which, as if by a law of fate, the rest of civilized mankind are forced to move, some with swifter, other with slower, but all with unresting feet." And in commemorating James Bryce tonight, we are delighted to welcome Orlando Patterson, who will speak on a subject that would have captivated not only James Bryce, but also Alexis de Tocqueville. His subject will be Ordinary Liberty, What Americans Really Mean by Freedom and Its Implications. Orlando Patterson is John Cowles Professor of Sociology at Harvard University, but as Mick has already indicated, he returns this evening to his alma mater, the London School of Economics, from where he earned his doctorate in sociology in 1965. After faculty appointments at LSE and then the University of the British, the University of the West Indies, he moved to Harvard in 1969 and since then has made a glittering career as one of the leading sociologists. His PhD dissertation was published as a book, Sociology of Slavery, Jamaica 1655 to 1838. And after that, he produced another major work on slavery, Slavery and Social Death, a comparative study published by Harvard University Press in 1982. His interest in the phenomenon of slavery prompted study of the nature and development of his shadow concept, freedom. The first volume of this project was published as Freedom in the Making of Western Culture, that was in 1991. And Professor Patterson is presently working on the second volume of this series. In the meantime, however, he has developed a particular interest in the intersection of race, immigration, and multiculturalism in the contemporary United States and has already published the first two volumes of a projected trilogy. These are The Ordeal of Integration, Progress and Resentment in America's Racial Crisis, and secondly, Ritual of Blood, The Consequences of Slavery in Two American Centuries. Orlando Patterson was awarded the American Sociological Association's Distinguished Contribution to Scholarship Award, the Sorokin Prize in 1983, and he has also been the co-winner of the Ralph Bunche Award of the American Political Science Association for the best scholarly work on pluralism. In 1991, he was awarded the National Book Award in Nonfiction for Volume 1 of his Freedom Study. And in addition to his scholarly achievement, since we're celebrating that polymath James Bryce, Orlando Patterson has also had a career that extends far beyond academia. He's had a distinguished career in governmental service as special advisor to Prime Minister Michael Manley for social policy and development in Jamaica in the 1970s. He also has had a parallel career as a novelist and critic, which includes publication of three novels, The Children of Sisyphus, An Absence of Ruins, and Die the Long Day. So without any further ado, I'm delighted to hand over to our Bryce Lecturer for 2006, Orlando Patterson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm grateful to the Institute and London University for inviting me here, inviting me back to my alma mater. It's been exactly, 40 years since I left this great institution. Nonetheless, I've had nothing but the fondest of memories, my stay here. And I lived and worked here at the best of times during the 60s, the cultural revolutionary years of Britain. I refer not to the Beatles or even to Mick Jagger, who had the bad grace to drop out of LSE the year before I arrived. We could have been just such great friends. Instead, I'm referring to that wonderful transition from the use of coal to the use of coke in the fireplaces of London. You don't know what that meant to someone coming from the colonies. I had my first pair of spectacles, you see, the day literally before I left the Third World, Jamaica, for Britain. And within 3 days, we had a fog. A real fog, and I was blindsided. I walked straight into a lamppost behind here, rushing to a lecture by Ernest Gellner, and smashed my glasses. After coke was introduced, we could all see again. We could all breathe again. But most importantly, we could all smell again. It was only after that that I discovered that the strange green stuff I had been eating in the cafeteria upstairs was intended to be curry. But I survived, as you can see. Though it has taken me 40 years to return. I've always had a soft spot for LSE, and I've always had a soft spot for the subject today, freedom. Now, the British may, with good reason, claim to be more responsible for the revival of freedom in the modern world than any other nation. But even though British historians have not been exactly understated in making this point known to the world, I think it is generally agreed that no country on earth celebrates liberty more than your cousin across the ocean, America. Any understanding of the political culture of America must come to terms with its central value and ideal, freedom. If there's one thing that all the great and small thinkers of that nation agreed on, it's that freedom is America's most cherished ideal and the foundation of its greatness. What's more, that America cherishes and experiences freedom more than any other country on earth. This is the American, firmly held American belief. In 1792, James Madison wrote in a vein of national triumphalism that was to persist to this day that, and here I quote, and I'm not misquoting, "In Europe, charters of liberty have been granted by power. America set the example, and France has followed it, of charters of power granted by liberty. This revolution in the practice of the world may, with an honest praise, be pronounced the most triumphant epoch of its history and the most consoling presage of its happiness. We look back already with astonishment at the daring outrages committed by despotism on the reason and rights of man. We look forward with joy to the period when it shall be despoiled of all its usurpations and bound forever in the chains with which it had loaded its miserable victims." They had a way with words, didn't they? There's been no letting up of this celebratory tone. Whether it's Emerson acclaiming how freedom all-winged expands, the national anthem proclaiming America to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, or the national song exulting on the sweet land of liberty, the battle hymn of the Republic, which co-opted Jesus Christ himself in the celebratory lines, "He died to make men holy, let us die to make men free." And of course, it's the Statue of Liberty and so on. These are all the great sort of icons leading up to America's claim to be the leader of the free world in the struggle against communism during the Cold War era. This obsession with liberty, this certainty that America is the land of liberty par excellence, and the claim of its leadership in the promotion of liberty throughout the world, of course, persist. Most recently, President Bush, a couple of years ago, in his State of the Union address, renewed the view that, or the claim that America's mission is to promote freedom throughout the world. But what does it all mean? Many thoughtful people have been puzzled by this question, the most famous being Abraham Lincoln, who lamented in 1864 that, I quote, "We all declare for liberty, but in using the word, we do not mean the same thing." There were good reasons for Lincoln's puzzlement and not other thoughtful Americans. Take first what I've called the paradox of the Confounding Fathers. Why was it that nearly all the Founding Fathers, and certainly the greatest of them, Jefferson, Washington, Madison, men who fought for and laid the foundations of the nation's freedom and celebrated it in some of the finest prose written by statesmen, were not just slaveholders, but large-scale slaveholders, and went to their noble graves holding hundreds of their fellow human beings in bondage? And there was a paradox that confounded Lincoln himself. Not just the fact that the southern half of the country had gone to war to defend slavery, but that Euro-American Southerners genuinely believed that they were doing so in the defense of their liberty. Liberty to enslave us a fifth of the nation. The paradoxes of slavery, of freedom, however, are not confined to the American past. And America puzzles many. It's the only modern industrial nation to execute its citizens. It has the highest incarceration rates in the world. There's a persistent threat of privacy from the corporate sector, which, and the Patriot Act, which I'll have more to say about later, severely threatens civil liberties. Even very conservative, and this is not a left-wing screed, even very conservative domestic organizations such as the Cato Institute, which gets as conservative as you can get, has expressed growing concern about recent developments. And there are major problems with the democratic process, which I hope to get to later on. I've been concerned with the problem of freedom for many years, and having become an American, and proudly so, I'm a citizen of America, I've been been fascinated and puzzled by this strange development in this culture. There are really two cultures of freedom in America. I think we should begin by making that clear. There's a formal public freedom, and in that regard, it is second to no other country. Constitutional protected liberties. This is, of course, the first nation to constitutionally enshrine liberties in the Bill of Rights. Highly institutionalized in its legal and political system, the rule of law thrives. America has more lawyers than any other country on the face of the earth. Active civil society, although increasingly elite dominated, but a thriving one. A political system with division of powers that works. Well, there's another culture of freedom in America, a culture of ordinary liberty. It's a highly privatized conception and experience of freedom. And it's what I'm going to talk about tonight. And let me sort of declare my hand, so to speak. The basic argument here is that what's peculiar, what's unusual about this practice of liberty among ordinary Americans is the fact that it is uncoupled from the political process. And it is very skeptical of that formal process of liberty, which I mentioned earlier. And my objective then is to examine closely this privatized view of freedom held by ordinary Americans. Constitutional theorists, political scientists work on the first. As a sociologist, I'm more interested in the second. That is, not what freedom ought to be, not what Sir Isaiah Berlin thinks freedom is, not what the lawyers think freedom to be, but what ordinary Americans think freedom is. How do they live it? What do they mean by it? How do they practice it? Astonishingly, very few people have actually asked this question or tried to answer it. And I've been doing this for the past several years, and I want to share some of my findings with you. And I want to discuss some of the main consequences of this highly privatized view and practice of freedom among ordinary Americans. What it means for American society, that other society, that other country, domestically, but also what it means for the rest of the world, given that America is now the only surviving superpower, which has declared as one of its major objectives the spreading, by hook or by crook, of freedom throughout the world. The data I use are primary and secondary historical sources, survey data, my own national survey conducted in 2000, a reanalysis of other people's survey data, interview data, conventional interviews, as well as a special kind of interviewing technique developed by Jerry Zaltman and a cognitive scientist at the business school at Harvard, which I'll explain in a minute, and newspaper accounts of Americans. I sort of basically examined 1 year of newspaper clippings having to do with freedom. Social scientists neglect the work of journalists too much, because what journalists I see is basically working anthropologists. And they're usually thousands of found ethnographists, as I call them, which sociologists can draw on, which I drew on for this study. So let's get down to it. Now, what I'll do is first discuss the findings from the survey, and then move on to the more interesting part of the talk, I think, which will be the in-depth analysis of the interviews I've done with many Americans, trying to get to the heart of what they really believe freedom to be. The first thing to note is that Americans claim to have a great deal of freedom. It's ordinary Americans. Well over 70% of them think that they have a great deal of freedom when asked. Now, what's interesting here is that there's actually surprisingly little difference between groups on this. I was surprised at that. I went in expecting to find much lower percentages from certain ethnic groups, for example, African Americans in particular. That, as the graph shows, that's not the case. I also thought I'd find much lower percentages among women. But again, not only is it not the case that women feel they have less freedom than men, but it turns out that women think they have a greater amount of freedom than American men. The that prediction took me by surprise because I'm particularly interested in gender issues. And I had felt confident that my prediction would have been borne out, but it wasn't. I suppose part of the reason was my own biases. I live in a very liberal part of America where women are more conscious of their freedoms and threats to their freedoms, and perhaps that bias was there in my the kind of questions I asked. But the average American woman feels that she has as much freedom, if not more, than men. At the same time, what is puzzling, I asked Americans about their perceptions of changes in the levels of their own freedom, as well as changes in the level of freedom among others in the nation. And it's interesting here that things get somewhat more interesting at this point. In the first place, I was surprised again that only about 44% of women told me, or told the interviewers, that they've had more freedom than previously. Surprised because with all the feminist movement and the very, very active women's movement in America, I would have thought that women would have perceived themselves to have had more freedom than they did in the past. But that is not so. And there are several reasons for this. One could be that recent developments, recent setbacks in the women's movement and the success, especially of the anti-abortion movement, the success of the campaign against the effort to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, may have been seen by many women as a setback, and which sort of is reflected in their view that they've had less change than they thought was likely to be the case. Gender, class, to some extent mattered. As a sociologist, of course, one is always interested in how class operates. I should point out from the beginning that there's surprisingly little variation along class lines in Americans' view of freedom. On the whole, poorer people think they have a little, somewhat less freedom, but they still think they have a lot. And that also explains a great deal about America. Why it is that, as Jennifer Hochschild once asked in a well-known study, why is it that the poor vote conservative, or more recently, what's the matter with people in Kansas, where by all sociological and socioeconomic sort of criteria should be voting strongly Democratic, but every time go to the poll, even with their unemployment slips and so on, votes very conservative. I think part of this has to do with America's view of their freedom and what they consider the threats to their freedom. Freedom in the ordinary sense. This is important because it explains a puzzle, something that has deeply puzzled many people, especially in the last election, where there is great concern about the fact that there's been an erosion of civil liberties, and I'll have more to say about this later on. And everyone thought that this would have been a plus for Kerry, who in fact played it up, but who got no response. To the contrary, on the other hand, one would have thought that Bush would have wanted to play this down, given the fact that everyone concerned with what I'm calling the former liberties, including, as I said, conservatives such as the Cato Institute, were arguing that there's a real threat to civil liberties. But quite apart from playing it down, every one of his speeches from the middle of the campaign played up the fact of freedom. You can't understand this unless you understand that these two cultures of freedom and the fact that Kerry was addressing one culture, the formal culture of liberty. Bush, and I didn't advise him, was addressing the other, what I'm calling ordinary liberties and what Americans really mean by freedom, which the Republicans thoroughly understand. So, Americans think they're very, very free, freest people in the world. Well, what do they mean by it? What do they mean by it? As I said, I use both open-ended questions in my survey as well as pre-coded questions and also interview data. So these are responsible to the first of our two open-ended questions. Know that they hold very positive views about freedom. It's doing what you want. Again, I couldn't help thinking since I went to this place as a student, you know, Sir Isaiah Berlin reigned supreme during my era here, and this two concepts of liberty kept nagging at the back of my head every time I sort of look at data. And of course, it's of no relevance here. Americans have a very positive view of freedom. It's doing what you want, exercising rights, although rights, as we'll see, not in the sense in which you might understand it, and making choices. Purely negative conception of freedom would seem to be of minor importance. But we have to be careful in drawing such a conclusion, because what may seem to be a positive conception of freedom could just as easily be interpreted as a negative view. And this is a thorny issue which I'd rather leave to political theorists. In the broadest terms, and there seem to be three classes of Americans. One group, the majority, we may call them sort of mainstream Americans in red there, about 51% from the class analysis, latent class analysis I did, who believe that freedom is getting what you want, having control, having the capacity to do things, having choices. There's a strong emphasis on the spiritual. This is one of the surprising findings. Americans feel that inner peace, both religious as well as secular inner peace, is an important dimension to freedom. And feel that the less government, the better. but also feel that, and one of the questions I asked is it okay in a free society to have great inequalities? Some people rich, some people very poor. And this first group of people, they're sort of not so sure about that. And of course, all agree on a free press. A second group, a second cluster of about a third of Americans are similar, except the sort of primary difference between them here is that they hold a sort of view of no government, but are a little bit more skeptical, are generally of the view that it's okay to have a lot of poverty along with freedom. There is no inconsistency. I see this as sort of more conservative Americans. A third group, I guess you'd call them sort of moderate liberals, are far less gung-ho on the idea that freedom is doing what you want. Control, yes, is important. They emphasize the spiritual, but they're less inclined to say, to take a view of minimal government as an important element of freedom. And they do not believe that inequality and freedom are consistent. All Americans are of the view that a free press is important. So that's in broadest terms, is what comes out from this kind of analysis. Let me look more closely at some of the main sort of constructs. Freedom is doing what I want. I'll have more to say about this from the interview data later on. But you'll see here that this is very much a male, both women and men feel this. I'm talking about odds here. The odds are much greater that men hold this view, that whites will rather than blacks. The more educated people are less inclined to hold this view. The big surprise here is that conservatives are less inclined to emphasize doing what one wants, getting what one wants, possibly a reflection of the fact that sort of more spiritual factors are important to American conservatives. Rights, turned out, this is a very interesting one. I mean, again, women somewhat more than men, but that very tall bar you see there, other ethnic, will be mainly Hispanics. And it's one of the interesting aspects of America today is that the people from my survey who turned out to be most sort of ordinary Americans who seem to be most aware of rights as an important dimension of liberty are immigrants. And it's significant that just a few weeks ago, as you know, there's a major campaign now of immigrant rights. And one of the things they've tried to do is to co-opt the civil rights movement, to reinterpret the immigrant movement as a civil rights movement. There's great anguish right now in the black community among black leaders as to whether they have a right to do that. But there's a strong sense of rights, and it's very intriguing over and over that, you know, people who come to America, of course, recognize this as the land of liberty. They take those ideas seriously, and so it's among immigrants that one is most inclined to find a sort of formal culture of freedom being important. And especially, I should say, immigrant women. This, again, looks mainly here at difference between men and women. As you can see, choice, inner peace, and being left alone, and on whether freedom is, it's okay to have freedom in is it consistent with an unequal society, significant differences between men and women. It's especially the idea of whether it's okay to have a more inequality with freedom. What we've been talking about so far has been mainly people's notions of freedom, but of course, how people experience freedom is what I was primarily interested in, and we'll be talking about mainly today. And in the survey, I asked people to tell me the sort of things which they are doing, what they experience when they're free. And sort of movement, security, leisure, inner freedom, being disengaged and engaged are the experiences that come up most often. Movement is by far the thing which Americans seem to associate with freedom, and this makes sense when you think of the significance, not just of the car, but this goes all the way back to traditional America, the prairie, the horse, and so on. And and this is still the case. My favorite is that of a man who tells me that he feels most free when he's in his pickup, driving along the highway, listening to Bruce Springsteen. And that comes up over and over again. It's predominantly a male thing, although a surprising number of women feel the same way. I want to draw attention, because I'm going to talk more about it when I get to the in-depth interviews, the engagement and disengagement. One of the interesting things here is that I expected to find, from what I've read of feminist studies, especially feminists who have analyzed, talked about sort of the relational aspects of greater emphasis on relationship among women, I expect to find that women would emphasize engagement with others as an important aspect of freedom. And that indeed turned out to be the case. What came as a real surprise in the analysis, gender analysis, was the fact that women as frequently emphasized the being disengaged as an important dimension of freedom. And I was intrigued by that, and this came out even more interestingly in my interviews. Okay, that more or less takes us to about the limits of what we found from the survey. Now, what we found is that they have a very positive view, is doing what you want, having choices and rights reflected in movement, leisure, engagement, disengagement. However, the most important finding is not stated. You know the old Sherlock Holmes tale that the real clue was the fact that the dog did not bark? Well, that's something like that. My most important finding is what I did not find, what people did not say. It's the almost complete absence of any reference to public civic life, political engagement, voting. We interviewed 1,450 people nationally. In fact, I say we, the NORC, which is perhaps the best survey organization in America. 15 people, statistically wholly insignificant number of people mentioned anything like voting or political participation. I was shocked. I was floored. That is the most important finding here. That's the dog that didn't bark in these findings. And that is what led me on to thinking, what's going on? How is this possible? Given the centrality and the importance. I mean, as I said, there is a powerful culture of public freedom in America. I mean, there are always elections, far more elections than there are in Britain. You know, your parliament meets elections every 5 years. We're talking about every 2 years. I mean, every time you turn around, there's an election in America. You'd have thought this would have been on the consciousness of every American. And if you ask about freedom, the first thing that would come to mind is, yeah, you know, I can vote. No. Well, the other thing I found is that there's no relation between the privatized view of freedom and how people behave politically. Couldn't predict from what they said about freedom how they voted. And that comes from another analysis in which I looked at their voting behavior and tried to relate their ideas of freedom to it. No relation. So the single most important thing to take from this then is the uncoupling of freedom, notions of freedom, from notions, anything having to do with the political domain. This is what I mean by the privatized view of freedom which exists in America. And it's quite startling. So let's, however, that surveys. I am a qualitative man. I do this if it's required, then it's useful. But you know, I always recall what a very wise Australian economist once said about tables, regression tables. They said they're like a bikini on a voluptuous woman on the beach. What they reveal is very important, as we've seen, but what they conceal is vital. And as a red-blooded Jamaican, I've always been concerned more with what is concealed by statistical tables. And we only get at what is concealed by doing the kind of interviews, data. I've interviewed over 200 Americans. What I'm going to be, what I'm going to say today is is to look at the 27 interviews using ZMET method. Before I get to that, though, I should just point out to you that I use another source of data, which is these newspapers, which are wonderful sources. And there's no mistaking America's profound commitment and belief in freedom. A source from a sample of 46 newspapers over a year between 1999 and 2000 were looked at. And over 355 stories about views and experiences of freedom were quoted and analyzed. Let me just give you one. It's a typical of these 355 stories. Called Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death. It comes from the Spokane news, local news. It's about a woman who had had Alzheimer's. And she had to give up one freedom after another, freedom in this privatized sense, but it was very important to her. But there's one last freedom, which is driving in her car, getting in her car. Her husband was retired, was happy to drive her, but she had to do this, driving the car to the gym each day, coming back. There was concern, they discussed it. And one day, she lost her way and didn't find her. They looked for her. The next morning, they found her in the park, just about 100 yards from the gym, and she had frozen to death. And there's a great deal of introspection in Spokane about this. Should they have done what any good European society would have done, which is to say this woman should not have been on her own? And the husband and several people were quite emphatic. Said, we discussed this, but it was a matter of freedom. And we'd do it again. He missed his wife, he loved his wife. But now, that's an example of give me liberty or give me death. And I have hundreds of stories like that. Americans really do cherish this thing called freedom, as they define it. And so I had to sit down and find out, beyond the survey data, what is it that's going on in their heads. And one way of getting at this is this new technique of interviewing, in which instead of just asking people what they think about freedom, is to explore the hidden meaning of what people believe through images. A week before the interview, we ask people to collect images on what expresses their ideas of freedom and what expresses their ideas of unfreedom. So they turn up to the interview, newspaper clippings, some of them take photographs, whatever images express their ideas. They turn up to the interview with these images. Now it's a kind of reverse Rorschach. With a Rorschach, the psychologist turns up with his pre-designed cards and get the person to interpret the card. In this case, I get the people to come up with their card, so to speak, and they interpret it for me, and I use those as cues for the interview. The interviews go on for over 2 hours. And it's called ZMET interviewing. We use various techniques. We use storytelling. We get people to have fantasies, stories in which freedom is one of the characters, and so on. And I can assure you it works. There's usually some point in the interview in which people say, did I really say that? And you know by then that you've locked into something deeper than what you could ever get from a survey. And the cognitive basis of this is the fact that people think in terms of images far more effectively than they think. In fact, if you ever listen to a transcript of an interview, you'll know that words don't convey very much. images, on the other hand, are a very powerful method of doing that. And I think we got to the heart of what Americans really, really felt. This plot here, I got from medical statisticians. It's called a Labe plot. And it's a way of keeping qualitative sociologists honest, I think. But one of the problems with reporting interview data is that you never know whether the person is cherry-picking his quotations. I know. I mean, I can always, you know, find, I have hundreds of pages of interviews. I can always pluck out whatever I want to support my argument. And I was bothered by this, being a very honest researcher. And what I did was the Atlas TI, which I used to analyze my data, divided into units, each unit simply being a thought, a completed thought. And you can then simply analyze these by simply getting the number of references to particular constructs. In this case, I was looking at the difference between men and women because that's the primary difference which emerges in the data. And what the chart does quite simply is simply plot the percentage of references to each of these constructs between men and women. And the size of the bulb around the plot gives you the relative ratio, that is to say, the relative significance for each group, men or women. That diagonal line there is called the line of equality or line of no difference, because basically anything that falls on this has a relative ratio of 1 or an odds ratio of 1 if you're using odds ratios, which means quite simply that it doesn't discriminate between men and women. And the chart is, as I said, keeps you honest because, you see, it's, for example, I was quite surprised at the fact that belonging, which I'd gone into the research thinking would be something which women would emphasize more than men, belonging, home, identity, and so on, turns out to fall exactly on this line of no difference. So again, self-actualization. It turns out I went in with a bias, or let us say a hypothesis, that women will more emphasize that. And, you know, I was quite surprised when I did the analysis of the interview data to find it falling exactly on that line, which told me that you're just wrong. I mean, men were as likely to emphasize this as women. So let's look at this more closely. Choice, control, autonomy, doing what I want are the core concepts defining freedom among our subjects. These are the basic components of freedom. Autonomy, as the Labe plot shows, falls exactly in the line of equality, which means that it's of equal importance to men and women. It's super cool. There are about 72 references. It subsumes all references to the concept of freedom as self-reliance, self-determination. Belonging and self-actualization, similarly, as I said, have no gender-specific connotations. Belonging includes ideas such as home, rootedness, being connected, and being enveloped as notions of freedom. And self-actualization, which this is another important way in which this graph is helpful, there's a tendency to emphasize what is of relative importance to the groups you're interested in. But if you look at this graph, you'll see that doing what I want is indeed a very important construct discriminating between men and women, as is emphasis on the body. But it's not necessarily the most important thing. The graph clearly shows that self-actualization position is sort of what men and women most commonly emphasize. Now I want to go through some of the more important these concepts through the eyes of and the images of the Americans I interviewed with you. Choice strikes this central concept. Among especially upper middle class people and especially middle class women, choice emerged along with control as a defining feature. Harriet, a very poised and articulate real estate consultant, was typical. Oh, by the way, this is a collage. At the end of the interview, we asked people to do a collage of all the images. And the collage itself tells you a lot. That is to say, we asked them to place the images in a given way. We put it on a computer, and we scan it, and we ask them to make a collage. And then we can analyze the collage separately from the individual interviews, and how they're situated become important. And we discuss with them why you place an image in a particular area. I don't have the time to go through the individual images, so I'll just show the collages here. This is upper middle class American woman. She said having choices, she said, meant having options. I think options are extremely important to me. And the more options I have, the more I feel free. Asked how she got to the point of sort of having many options, Harriet was emphatic. You have to create them, she answered. Okay, when you have more options available to you and you understand what they are and you're comfortable with them, and by the way, an option is only valid if it's something you would gladly have. If it's a compromise, it's not an option, it's not a choice, so on. It, she says, that gives her tremendous freedom. And asked what it does to her to have tremendous freedom, she replied unhesitatingly, it gives you power. The power to say yes and the power to say no. Harriet's two dominant images of freedom were a group of modern male dancers in full motion, seeming to defy gravity, and a wad of $100 bills. She used the image of the dancers to make the distinction, crucial for our middle and upper middle class subjects, that between the choices they made and what she called choice by default, the choices that are made almost unconsciously or because they are expected of you and that are as often as not pre-made. These are choices, she said, made in a world of shoulds. It's living on the conditional, she said. Real choices, she insisted, are those made and created consciously. Americans, it turns out, have an extraordinarily sophisticated grasp of what choice is and means. And it really took me by surprise. Sort of ordinary people talking about this at great length. Sometimes they'll go on for 15 minutes on just what choice means to them. It's quite impressive. All middle and upper class Americans seem exhilarated by their ability to create their own options and as such determine their choices. And there's been a lot of cynical stuff written about Americans and their choices and the fact that they can go shopping and that they don't really have, it's a superficial sort of a view of choice, the sort of 100 different kinds of coffee you can get in Starbucks and so on. Americans are fully aware of that, and as I said, that distinction becomes very critical. The choices that are made for you and the choices that you make, it came up over and over, certainly among middle and upper class Americans. I found it interesting, by the way, that working class Americans tend to emphasize choice less than the middle class responded. But all the middle class people are really accelerated by that. It gives genuine fulfillment. It's one person described it. They use these extraordinary languages. It's sort of real choices create what one person called a blank slate of creativity. Another woman said, I quote, you have the choice to test yourself and to choose your quality of life. And yet another went so far as to speak of the tool of choice. I spent a lot of time trying to get at what she meant exactly by that. And she meant something, but I didn't quite get it. But this we're talking about a group of people for whom choice has been very well thought out. And as I said, it's one of the fundamental ideas of freedom. Control, and another thing to note, is important, is that all the Americans I interviewed felt that there are no external obstacles, as Anne Switler found with her subjects too. No, however serious, can negate the individual's ability to choose. Control, secondly, is close to being perhaps the central component of Americans' conception and experience of freedom. It's about equal in significance to men and women, although men and women express it somewhat differently. And control operates in all contexts. I was very surprised, for example, when a mother, very proud of being a mother, this is a low middle class woman, spoke very movingly about the control she had over her children and how that constituted a very important aspect of what made her feel very free. This is how she described her relationship with her children. It's knowing that they are with you, and no matter what happens anywhere, there could be an earthquake, there could be a storm, there could be a fire, anything, no matter, you have the power to protect them, the physical power to protect them. And asked what that did for her, she said, "It makes me feel in control, which is a key to making me feel free. I don't know why, but in control, I'm just happy." They're good kids. They have fun, and they're cool to be around. So that's the other part of it. But as far as making me feel free, as far as feeling free, it makes me feel like I don't owe anything to anyone. I don't have to call and check with anybody. They're mine. That's her sense. That she gets her feeling of freedom from that. Note something here, that this is about as private as you can get in your notion of freedom, your relationship with your children. She's getting her sense of freedom from her interaction with her children. The idea of physical and mental control, of being fully conscious and in the present, recurred over and over. Roberta, an interior decorator in her mid-50s, said, I find butterflies the ultimate. I'd sort of skip over that. Let's leave her butter and her butterflies. She said she felt that, can't find the image. I find butterflies the ultimate in feeling free, being able not only to be beautiful, but fly around and light on flowers and make me feel good. I think probably makes a butterfly feel good too. And asked, how does that relate to her notion of freedom? She said, I feel independent. I feel I'm in control of myself, my nature, my well-being. Men more typically emphasize control in a sense of control over others. Again, the feminist literature on women's notion of power and control as one which involves empowering themselves through empowering others came out very forcefully in my survey. Whereas men tend to emphasize control towards an important dimension of freedom, but control over others. And still, a low middle class African-American man told us that his most exhilarating feeling of freedom came from beating others on the basketball court. Yeah, because I know that I'm a good basketball player, and to have my way with someone on the court, that's kind of like being free, so I feel really good about that. Someone is trying to defend me and they can't, and after I score, I run back and I'll say something like, I thought you were playing defense. Or just something like that, just to keep me going. And it takes a couple of hours of that, and I'm good, and then I go back to my quiet, silly self, and that's it. In a middle-aged gay man in his mid-40s, that's his collage, brought an image of a gay circuit party to the interview, which he called a picture of freedom. And said he felt most happy and free when he took over. I'm just a very dominant personality. I'm in control most of the time. My boyfriend was like, you know, he went along with the ride. He was a great partner to do that with, just because he was just like, this is great. And so on. However, the image I like most came not in one of the actual images, but when we asked people to invent stories about freedom. And one man said, I put a bunch of rocks and I built any kind of rock wall in that river. okay? Then I can divert the course of the river so that over time the river will change. I can flood an area. I can dry up an area, you know. When probed about how all this relates to freedom, he said, it gives me a sense of control and power over my life. There's only so much time you have to be here, you know. If there are things you want to, you should start working on it. You know, try to be the person you want to be instead of, you know, letting life or people hold you down. Go back. Be the river. And many of you have seen that ad all over New York and London, sort of, be a tiger. I mean, how many of you know that the subtext was be free? Doing what one wants is, as the quotation analysis showed, one of the things that discriminates most between men and women. The point I would like to make most about this is that Americans strongly, especially American men, emphasize this. And being left alone to do what you want, this is a typically male set of images of freedom. And this idea of being left alone to do what you want came out very strongly in a working class Irish American man who just liked to go to the ocean. Just being left alone, away from people, away from the pressures of family members. They pressure me with all these invitations and surprise parties, party for this one, for that one, the 50th, the 60th. It's a lot of pressure. It does a job on your head. Everybody has their own mind. They have the right to do what they want. I do too. I choose not to go. I don't answer the phone. This is my freedom of rights. This is my freedom of rights. Now, listen to the way the concept of rights is being used here. He's talking about his relationship with his predators, whom he can't stand. And it's a matter of his rights that he doesn't even have to answer the telephone when they invite him to one of their wretched parties. It's my freedom of rights. Nobody is going to push me around. That's, again, you see how this notion of rights has nothing to do with the political here. It has to do with personal interactions. There's a lot of anxiety about control and doing what one wants. And one of the points I want to emphasize here, one of the real surprises that came out in my study of these Americans, is how all of this relates to work. Americans strongly believe that they should have control and get what they want. And when this is combined with another important value associated with freedom, the idea that life and work should be fulfilling, it creates real problems for them. Now, but this actually took me by surprise. Americans, as you know, work harder than any other group of people in the industrial world. At least, well, let me correct that. They work longer. Economists are not so sure whether they're more productive, but they certainly work longer hours and have fewer holidays than English people or Germans. And they strongly feel that work should be not just productive, but fulfilling. But this is not the case anymore. Maybe among the Puritans it was on those wonderful farms. But this is a brutal globalized economy that Americans live in now, in which this whole idea of workers' fulfillment doesn't quite work. And the stories that people have to say about work is really was sad. I mean, one person described this as, he showed me a picture of his boss. And he said, he immediately began to sweat and get anxious. He said, this is a poor lady here. I should really cover her face, but none of you are going to Boston, so it's okay. This is making me feel not free. This picture represents my non-freedom, my chains, my shackles, my glass ceiling. For Sandra, a middle-class woman, she's talking about moving from the controlling environment of work where you never really have a moment to yourself. You're kind of frustrated. You're not happy. Now, the amazing thing was that I found this attitude right through the class system. The people I interviewed were unusual in that I had quite a number of upper-class and upper-middle-class Americans, one of the advantages of working collaboratively with someone from the business school. And I was quite amazed to find a woman who had what anyone would consider a dream job. She was head of a consulting team in a top 100 company, earning a six-figure salary, traveling all around the world first class. She seemed to have everything. And yet, in the interview, she said, "I don't feel free at all. Because at work, I feel very constricted, very, you know, I have no control. So I think for me, freedom equals having control over my life to do the things I want," and so on. The person who, one of the things that comes out in the images, this is perhaps the best image on this, the watch comes up over and over. Look at the watch in this image, and look at that cartoon of the boss three times the size of the employee. And this is a middle-class man, another a restaurant consultant. As far as the job goes, I think being free is something that you really enjoy doing. He insists that it should be fulfilling, but it's not. I mean, when you work somewhere, you want to help the company do well, you want people to like you, you want people to think you're doing a good job for the company, and when you get fired, maybe you look at yourself. Now listen to this. You don't get angry and say, "Well, maybe I didn't do a good job. Maybe I didn't do what I set out to accomplish." Now, there's a lot I've talked about, so I have to cut short this analysis. I just want to say that, emphasize once again, that there are two important differences between men and women. One is this, what I call the engagement-disengagement syndrome, which I hinted at, which came out in the survey, and which came out powerfully in the interviews. The fact that women strongly emphasize engagement, as the feminist literature predicts, but equally emphasize disengagement as important aspect of freedom. And there's no inconsistency here. That disengagement is almost a time for emotional recharging. The one woman does it quite well. She spoke eloquently, illustrated it. The two experiences of freedom, freedom as engagement, freedom as getting away, with two images, a minivan and a pair of shoes there. Both represent the opportunity to travel physically and hence freedom. However, the minivan represents the freedom of deep engagement with her family, a personal thing with me, my van and my kids. The shoes represent the capacity to make a speedy getaway and just be by herself. The other, finally, from the interviews, important aspect of the difference has to do with embodiment. This is the single most important difference between men and women. The differences were stark. Nearly all the women we spoke to spontaneously raised the subject of their bodies when talking about freedom. And the body emerged independent of class and ethnicity, both as metaphor and as the basis of the experience of both freedom and unfreedom, as object and as agent, in ways wholly consistent with what we've learned from feminist theorists and students of gender. I don't have the time to go through all of them. This woman, an African-American woman, said, "Start with me. It's a picture of me on the day of a wedding that I went to. I like the picture because it makes me feel most free, because it's actually like the first time that I really wore a dress that fit me." And losing weight, she explained, had major consequences for her. It made her more confident. "I'm able to walk down the street and not worry about anyone saying negative things. I can be myself." This, in turn, gave her a positive view of life, which helped her to know what's wrong and right. And knowing what's wrong and right meant that she did not end up neglecting her children. But now, this is a low middle class woman, but a middle class woman is just as much. This woman gave this picture of this model. "I do not feel free when I look at pictures in magazines because it reminds me of how I feel about life, like I'm not happy with my body, and so that reminds me of, and it makes me feel, it doesn't make me feel free, it just reminds me of what I need to be doing. You know, it's constant what I need to be doing physically at the gym, and I'm not necessarily motivated at the moment, so it makes me feel not good. I'm not free. I don't feel free in my I don't feel free in my womanhood, and so on and so forth. There's sort of scores of references to that. Men almost, although men are very much involved with their bodies as students of masculinity have pointed out, not in this way. And it certainly doesn't come out as an element of freedom. I want to move on, however, from this to look at let me just mention one thing, that it's also used as a metaphor, not just of freedom, but of unfreedom. This is a powerful image which a woman brought in. Spent about half an hour talking about, this woman and this sort of invasion of space which women experience, which makes them feel unfree, and then the need to sort of have your own personal space is very important. This is a very, very moving statement from many American women on this subject. This is just a summary of what we've been saying, a kind of native model by Americans of what freedom means. It's primarily a matter of self-determination, although they acknowledge that opportunity and upbringing may be important. But people make critical life decisions, which is their own, of their own responsibility, which determine their independence, which is the major cause of these primary bases of freedom, choice, control, doing what I want, major part of freedom. I wish I had more time to discuss this with you, but I don't. The conclusions. Freedom is alive and well in America. It's powerfully institutionalized in the courts, the free press. Americans have great commitment to it, unto death. But it has been largely divorced, as we've seen. And by the way, the interview data reinforced what was already found in the survey data. You speak to people for 2.5 hours about freedom, and at the end of it you say, hey, Bill, we've been talking about freedom all this time. What about democracy? You never once mentioned anything having to do with this. And you said, oh yeah, of course. I assume I take it for granted. But this is quite extraordinary. We're talking about hundreds of hours of interviews in which not a single person ever mentions anything to do with politics in the course of, or very personal. These interviews were very personal, very deep-seated analysis. So the uncoupling has been divorced, except for an active 15% of the population. What it means is that formal constitutional liberties no longer have the psychological support of our cherished notion of freedom. We'll skip that. There are dangers in this privatization. Political and civic apathy, plutocratic polity, the incumbency problem in congressional seats, the threats to civil liberties, internationally, America's ability to be the leader of the free world is severely compromised. Just very quickly to go through some things which you may know already. Voter apathy, the percentage of voter turnout for all elections in selected democracies from 45 to 2000. As you can see, America comes last. Now, a few economists and political theorists have been questioning whether the studies of voter apathy are indeed accurate. I think they are. The emerging plutocracy, campaign finance law without teeth, the lobby scandal. Jack Abramoff is just the tip of the iceberg. Laws written by interest groups, they're not meant to regulate. Increasingly, only the rich or those with access to great wealth can now contest senatorial or even congressional seats. The incumbency crisis, let's just look very quickly at some of the data here. It's the least addressed, you may not have heard about this, but perhaps the most serious aspect of, a troubling aspect of the nation's democracy. No serious contest in the majority of congressional seats in America. Incumbents, it's a sure thing almost. Over 85% of people are routinely reelected. So in many cases, they don't even have an opposition because people don't see the point. The high cost of election, the powerful sphere of special interests are at play. Here, this has been a recent film since the 70s. Look at that graph. The cost of beating a U.S. incumbent adjusted for, as you can see, it's now up to $1.5 million dollars. Got a buck to spare? This looks at, from the Center for Responsive Politics, the what it costs to unseat a senator or a person in the House. As you can see, it's big money. The average raised by the incumbent for Senate seats is $5.8 million. By the challengers, the average raise is $1 million. It's a little different in open seats. For the House, the average raised by incumbents, about $900,000. By the challengers, $197,000. With odds like that, you shouldn't be surprised if the Democrats do not make a dent on. But of course, things do change because the Democrats were in control for a long time. And one of the things which excite political scientists, of course, is explaining those swings. But I'm not a political scientist, so I'm not going to explain those swings to you. They're all anticipating such a swing this fall. But you see what the odds are. You see what they're up against. And that goes for Democrats as well as Republicans who hold seats. Then there are the sort of post-9/11 threats. The Patriot Act. What's a group of lawyers called the new normal? A secretive government. You know, traditionally, the fundamental assumption of American government was that you had a transparent government and the individual has his privacy, which was sacred. This has been turned around. Government has become incredibly secret. And the individuals, this has lost much of his privacy. Wiretaps, electronic surveillance are now routine. Access to private men is not just from the government. Access to private medical library and other records is routine. Freedom of expression, the press is threatening. There's been the jailing of journalists, the censoring of NASA scientists recently, legal assault and habeas corpus, and the preventive detention of citizens, indefinite detention of enemy combatants. That's been in the news today, three of whom committed suicide in Guantanamo Bay yesterday. Ethnic targeting of South Asians and Arab Americans. There's a very sad sight a few years ago. We saw hundreds of Pakistanis lining up in the border Canada trying to get the hell out of America because they just had it with the targeting of Asians and Arabs. As far as I wish, privatization of freedom is a major part of this problem. I attribute not all, but a good part of these problems to this. There's either indifference to our constitutional liberties and practices, or they are recklessly taken for granted. And as FDR, you know, the great free leader of freedom, said, the only sure bulwark of continuing liberty is a government strong enough to protect the interests of the people and a people strong enough and well enough informed to maintain its sovereign control over the government. We've lost that. The Economist, in a generally sympathetic article, and he's quite sympathetic to the present government, pointed out in 2003 that although one of the principal aims of the American Constitution's Bill of Rights was to restrict the government's powers to spy on suspects and lock them up preventively, this legal tactic has drawn few protests. The ultimate testimony to the privatization of freedom is the growth of cost-benefit analysis of liberty. In October 2003, the U.S. Budget Office published a notice seeking expert advice on how to measure the indirect cost of lost liberty and other lost liberties due to tightened security. You believe that? Kip Viscusi and Richard Zuckhauser, colleagues of mine, very distinguished fellow, one legal law school, one in the Kennedy School, took up the challenge. And among their findings, 44% of Harvard law students favored racial profiling at airports if it saved them 10 minutes. 74% were in favor if it saved them an hour. And this has now become a new branch of cost-benefit analysis, by the way, cost-benefit analysis of liberty. Anybody interested? There are lots of grant money for that. And Kip concluded, clearly, people are willing to make trade-offs. The irony of ironies here, though, is that the ACLU and Ralph Nader both in desperation, I'd say that they actually favor these cost-benefit analysis because it's the only way they can think of in this highly privatized view of labor that will persuade people. That perhaps the bureaucrat will stop and think if you say the cost is too much to go and conduct surveillance on your citizens. I mean, that may count, not any notion of freedom. That, it's due. International claims are compromised. America's noble claim to promote freedom, and I'm all for that, globally, problem is how, has been severely compromised, not only by our foreign policy, but by a discrepancy between our formal liberties and our practice of democracy, and especially in discrepancy between our formal constitutional expression of freedom and our ordinary practice of it. And think of Ed Murrow, who once said, we cannot defend freedom abroad by deserting it at home. And to conclude then, the greatest danger. The price of all freedom requires great vigilance and active citizenship, as Jefferson so repeatedly, active citizenship in a virtuous republic. Those who expect to reap the blessing of freedom must, like men and women, we should have now undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Americans are not prepared to do that. The greatest political irony and danger in America is that our very privatized conception and practice of freedom paves the ground for the conditions that may result in their erosions. Our hatred of politics, and there have been at least a half a dozen books with the title Why Americans Hate Politics, our contempt for politicians, our apathy towards government and civic participation, and our insistence on taking our formal liberties for granted mean that we leave politicians to do as they please with democracy, the bulwark of the very private freedoms that we so deeply cherish and are prepared to die for. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you for a truly splendid talk, Orlando, which has opened our eyes to a variety of concepts of freedom. Now, if you're not too tired, you've been performing splendidly for quite a while. Orlando Patterson is very happy to take questions from the audience. So would anybody like to pose a question to Professor Patterson? Okay, we have one in the middle. Do you want to stand up and shout out?
Take the mic first. I'll just sit down. Yeah, sure. Let Orlando. Yeah, please.
Yes, Professor, I thought your talk was very interesting. My one question is, you mentioned how in the private conception of freedom, Americans never mention political freedom at all. What about in their private conceptions of unfreedom? Was the government ever a major factor? Because you talked about how there's problems with the disconnect.
Right. No, that's the amazing thing. No, it's all personal. It all has to do with relationships. As their jobs, and their family, their friends, and their enemies, and so on. Freedom has to do with personal interaction. No, I mean, it's a good question. You'd have thought so. But as I said, it's the same thing that motivated the author of What's the Matter with Kansas? why? And as I said, Huxhall has looked at that problem too. Several political scientists have been bothered by that. But the simple answer is no.
Okay, I'm probably better attuned because my eyes are attuned to the top. Yeah, there's a chap at the back there, yeah, please. And we'll take a couple together, Orlando, okay?
Okay.
Please, yeah. Sir.
Yes, sir.
Use the mic, please. Can't hear you otherwise. Cheers.
Thank you.
Well, that's a kind of multiple independent re-entry vehicle. We call that a triple warhead.
Okay.
would you like to start with the Monroe Doctrine, move on very rapidly through Martin Luther King?
Yeah, the Monroe Doctrine of 1823, I mean, I'm not quite sure how many people... it was the beginning of America's sort of flexing its wings as an imperial power. When it didn't have the might to sort of actually... It is all talk. It is... But of course, later on, it did. So I'm not quite sure whether how applicable it is anymore. I mean, as I said, when the doctrine was declared, it was largely bombast. I mean, the British could still sort of do what they want and anyone else. And but if by that you mean whether America's sort of later policy of towards Latin America. What is in danger of destroying that? No. In fact, the problem I'd say in America right now is the danger of treating Latin America with indifference, except for Cuba, and increasingly Venezuela. But by and large, this is one big yawn as far as, I mean, if you're the State Department, well, there are people here who are more qualified than I am, but in the State Department, Latin America is one big yawn, and except when troublemakers like Perez and Castro show up. So, no, I mean, if anything, I'd say people certainly in the Caribbean would like America to take a little more interest in what's going on. Have Americans become complacent? No, I don't think so. But strange things have happened in American race relations. I don't know what you mean by complacent. What's emerged in America now is this is the age of identity. And identity politics trumps good sense quite often. And I have very many examples I could give you on that. My favorite one is in Georgia when the African-American leadership allowed the Republicans to run circles around them by trading in fact, a greater number of African-Americans for what turned out to be a wholesale sort of capturing of the state by Republicans. And but they had more leaders, but leaders who then were in a situation of not being able to do anything. I mean, it's complicated. I would need more time to spend on that. My simple answer would be no, I don't think African Americans become complacent, but I'm not quite sure whether they're going down the right track. And I think identity politics is perhaps overdone. It certainly was necessary at one time. I think it's become counterproductive in many respects. I mean, it's achieved its goals. African-American Europeans, Euro-Americans, in many ways, depends on how you want to measure it. I mean, if you want to measure it with survey data, the sort of thing Larry Bobo does, and which I sort of analyze sometimes, you know, to the degree that that's an accurate reflection of changing attitudes, it's gotten better. There are far fewer racists, and the majority of Americans, white Americans, do not claim to be racist. My estimate using other kinds of measures, political campaigns and so on, is that only about a fifth of American whites can be said to be racist now. That's still too many, but that's a hell of a lot different from the way it used to be. I think relations between the two groups have improved tremendously. As a matter of fact, let me make a contentious statement. Of all multiracial societies, I think America now has the best record in terms of laws that exist to protect minorities, in terms of the, as far as the black population goes, the exercise of power. No other country comes anywhere close to America. I mean, there is a genuine black elite now, and it's not just a token elite. I mean, you know, the second or third most powerful person in the country, Condoleezza, is a black woman. And the most powerful cultural icon and figure, the most influential figure in American culture is Oprah Winfrey. But more important than that, in the corporate sector, as Fortune magazine in a recent article pointed out, there have been major, major incursions in the upper echelons of the corporate sector by black Americans. No other my favorite comparison is Brazil, which is a majority black society. Look at the Brazilian middle class. Look at the Brazilian parliament. Look at the Brazilian foreign service. I mean, it's a wipeout. It's all white. So, yeah, my answer, yes, is that it's, for all its problems, this is one area in which it's done better given especially its horrendous past than any other mother country. Any other country. And it's been an example to other countries. Brazil now models its recent laws on America, so is South Africa. So, yeah, sure. I mean, there's one positive thing I can say.
I've got two or three more to go. I've got the lady at in the middle there. Yeah, please. Yeah.
As far as these really fascinating findings and this dichotomy is concerned, when do you think this split arose? When do you think this privatization started? And is it related at all to the rise of the consumer society?
Right. No, that's a very, very good question. One, I had to leave out one part of my talk, which is to explain how this all came about. And actually, it's fascinating that you said that, because yes, it is connected with the rise of consumer society. It's connected with when liberalism arose, it demonized the state all over. Liberalism emerged here, and the idea that the state is the bogeyman, threatening your individual liberties. Now, what happened in Europe was that the welfare state emerged and, in a sense, sort of gave the state back some kind of credibility. And people saw this sort of the freedom in terms of these sort of security. That didn't happen in America. There's a welfare state which emerged in an ad hoc way. And more importantly, the strong emphasis on the fact that the state is a potentially evil thing persisted and was successful. You can't attack the state without attacking democracy. Ultimately, that worked. I mean, American politicians have a very low repute in every survey among Americans. And increasingly, that's also true of the American political institutions. Now, however, and consumer society is another important dimension of this. But the third one, the really fascinating thing, is what Ann Douglas, this wonderful student of women's history, called the feminization of American culture, is a very important factor. Because you know what happened? Women, as you know, were excluded from the public sector. And three kinds of women sort of leadership emerged. There are those, the suffragettes, who demanded inclusion in the public sector. There were those, started by Ann Douglas, who were people who sort of saw freedom, exercised freedom, within the private domain. Sort of men said, you're virtuous, okay, we'll make a virtue of that fact. But then there's a third group, which in a sense created increasingly a space between the private and the public. So the women were told during the Republican motherhood phase that their job was to create the wonderful virtuous men to run the Republic, said, yeah, but if we have to do that, we need schools, and therefore we have to become teachers. We need healthy people, therefore we have to become nurses. And in that way, created a space between the two. Now, these three processes are very interesting, because what happened is that after the suffragettes won the vote, there was a collapse of political concern, but an increase in this highly privatized view. Now, what happened with the second wave of feminism is very interesting. What is a major, major sort of battle cry? The private is the public. Preoccupation with things private is the public. Now, that's a radical statement. But a funny thing happened on the way to the revolution. They found coming in the opposite direction a group of very conservative men saying, aha, the public is the private. Mm-hmm. And a strange embrace, or a strange kind of reinforcement took place. Too complex for me to get into now, but those are the lines along which I explain this. Those are the main factors.
Orlando, I've got a number of hands going up. I'm going to take some very brief questions. I'll start with the gentleman at the back. Yeah, a brief one, please. Yeah. Yeah, brief. Yeah, B-R-I-E-F.
Brief. No messages for back home.
Yeah.
I'll pass.
All right, okay. That's brief. Lady here, please. Yeah.
I'll try to be brief. First and foremost, I'm dying to say this. I'm Dutch, and I do not agree one bit that America is the country that is most protecting minority rights. I think the Dutch are much better at that.
Right.
Having a few famous black women or black people in the top echelons of wealth does not mean that the reality.
Okay,
is
okay.
My question to you is this. I quickly, out of all the slides you so quickly went through, America's, I quote, America's noble claim to promote freedom globally is greatly compromised. I would say this is a serious understatement of the fact that American governments have managed throughout history, the last 50 years especially, to violate deliberately, and still to do so, violate deliberately the freedom of other people and the control over themselves around the globe in the interest of their economy and their international businesses, with virtually no opposition from inside America itself, save for a few voices like Chomsky and Edward Said, etc.
Now the question.
Does this idea of privatization of freedom explain this?
Thank you very much. That was briefish. gentleman at the back there. Thank you. Yeah, please.
Would you perhaps consider that when the three branches
speak
of
up, please.
Sorry, would you perhaps consider that when all three branches of government are controlled by the same party, the freedom and the balance of power is challenged? And on a lighter vein, The Economist has been following a congressional primary in Illinois where a very senior Republican came out of retirement to challenge the incumbent, his point being that congressmen are like diapers. They need to be changed often and for the same reason.
My goodness. Lavatorial humor here.
Well,
gentleman at the back there, please. Yeah, move around quickly, and then a lady here, and then we'll finish.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your colleague, Robert Putnam, chronicles some of this in Bowling Alone. And in fact, he leaves one a bit uncomfortable because the reasons for the decline in civic society, including the interest in politics, are associated with things like urban sprawl and so on, and one doesn't see any end to that. Do you feel confident? Do you think that it's at all possible in the future to reconnect the private view of freedom with the public view?
Okay, I'm going to take one more because the lady's been had her hand up. I know there's a number of our hands gone up, but I'm conscious of time. Right, this will have to be the last one, please. I know it's general. Yeah, please.
I was also interested in the question of when privatization began, and I wondered in a different sense also about the relation of public and private. That is, in thinking about American politics recently, the culture wars have been a primary preoccupation.
Right.
Do you think it's possible the culture wars have gone postmodern in an explicit attempt to erase the boundary between public and private with an eye to reducing political accountability?
Hmm. Wow. Right. Okay, Orlando. Over to you. No more slurs on the Dutch or anybody else. Okay.
Right. You know, the irony of the Dutch is that they were the worst colonialists. And
no, the Belgians. No. That was the Belgians. That was the Belgians. You got the wrong country.
Okay. No, look. I'm from the Caribbean.
We were all awful.
I'm from the... Nonsense? Oh.
Yeah,
well. South Africa.
Belgium.
Anyway, let's... Hello, I'm from the Caribbean. I saw the Caribbean and Latin America. I mean, and spent a good deal of time talking about American foreign policy. You're absolutely right. America has a lot to answer for, and it's sort of its record in Africa, in Latin America, explains a good deal. The supporting dictators over progressive movements. There's no doubt about that. I'm saying when I say it's a noble aim. What I'm saying is that, as a great lover of freedom, I support the any effort by the only superpower to promote freedom. It's how it's done, you know, to promote freedom at the barrel of a gun. But if you do it the right way, I'm all in favor of it. And occasionally a little pressure, I don't mind. You know, I mean, that's what happened in Japan, and so sometimes that works. And I mean, it's and it seems to me a little pressure in Zimbabwe might also do some good. I'm totally aware of this record. Spent a lot of time teaching it and so on. I do think that a great opportunity maybe we're missing now, in the sense that at the end of the Cold War, there was this possibility that America could indeed play that role, and people were quite open to embrace that, and it was blown. it was largely blown. But it still remained a noble goal, spreading freedom. And since they're the richest, most powerful country in the world, if some new president with a different view respects international treaties and so on, and takes up that that as America's mission, I'm all for it. The incumbents are probably, efforts have been made to do this, the most important being laws, restrict the number of time a person can run. And that fell apart. Interestingly, there was a conservative movement, and not altogether sure. Well, in a way, it's the power of private interests which explains it. I mean, it was, and some people have argued that the complexity of government is such that having newcomers too often makes it difficult. But I find it interesting that it was a conservative movement, which I was always ambivalent about. I think it had merits. But the situation right now is one in which I would not, or anyone, unless you're rich or are married to a very rich person, as Kerry was, it's not something you want to take on. But the question of private, what's going to happen? I still have a lot of hope that the feminist movement and that women will carry the day on this, because the idea that the private is the public, I mean, the radical movement, women in the movement saw clearly that political, when they said that the political was critical, in that in tune with the suffragettes who saw that from the mid 50s. And things may have gotten lost with the different kinds of feminists, the sort of cultural feminists, right, the difference feminists, the big breakup, and which sort of tend to emphasize more the Catherine MacKinnon sort of approaches and so on. And but even she, of course, was fully aware of the fact that laws were important. So my sense is that it's to American women that I look for this for this reconciliation of the public with the private, because I mean, where else can one look? I mean, it's they who have most to gain from this. One of the big surprises of my interviews was I didn't find the level of radicalism, or rather engagement, that I expected among African Americans, whose views, except for African American women again, who I didn't have the time to get into that distinction, who are quite different from men in that regard. But African-American men and Euro-American men have very similar views. So my simple answer is that, yes, I think it's possible. It's also possible that it may come from that 15% of the population who constitute the active civic society, from most analysis. You see, America has a very powerful active civic community. Don't misunderstand me. It's there, it's alive, it's well. But it's largely a matter of the top 15% of the population. They're the ones who write the op-eds. They're the ones who are sort of man the think tanks. They're the ones who are all the sort of, the talking heads and so on. And they're very much alive, and they're on both sides. They're right-wing think tanks, they're left-wing think tanks, they're centrist think tanks. So there's a very rich, lively culture. The problem is, it's up there. From the best estimate, 10-15%. Come election times, it expands a bit as towards election, maybe another 15% may be drawn in, and that's the political community. And that's the problem. Because the problem is between elections, all sort of things can be done. Scary things, like what's happening now. And unless you have this re-engagement of freedom with the political, the conditions will be ripe for the kind of threat to civil liberties which has alarmed, as I cannot emphasize too much, not just liberals like myself, but very, very conservative people like the Cato Institute, who are about as far to the right as you can get, who have expressed alarm at what's happening. We're talking about preventive, the tension which is applied not only to the people in Guantanamo Bay, but to at least two American citizens. We're talking about the recent revelation of massive surveillance of telephone talks. I mean, we're talking about serious threats, which people are largely indifferent to. The top 15%, all the noise is coming from the top 15%. My people, the people I'm looking at, couldn't care less. As a matter of fact, the same year that I did my survey, a survey was done on privacy, and the results were alarming. The things that Americans said they are prepared to put up with. It's a serious problem. This is not just an alarmist one.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Orlando. Well, it's been a splendid occasion. I have a number of people that I need to thank on behalf of the Institute for the Study of the Americas. First of all, the Cold War Studies Center for co-hosting the event. Secondly, the London School of Economics for so splendidly putting on the event in the old theater. But most importantly, of course, I have to thank our Bryce lecturer for 2006, who has given us a most enthralling and engaging talk. I suspect we could go on for another hour with questions and answers, but I think our freedom to exploit you must be curtailed. So I will ask everybody to show our appreciation in the traditional form. Thank you very much.